Hey, it's episode 417 of the 343 podcast. Today is a very practical episode. Benny wanted to talk about what do you do when you're going to play a knockout game, specifically on the order of like a semifinal or like a final. What do you do as a coach? Because the elements do change. The anxiety levels go through the roof. The pressure is a little bit higher. The experience is a little bit lower because obviously you don't play semifinals and finals every day or knockout games every day of the week. And so there's a skill associated with this from a coaching perspective. How do you manage your players? How do you train leading up to the final, whether it's in a tournament play or whether you have a week-long's worth of preparation? And there's a lot of context to consider. For instance, have you had this team for a long time? Have you not had this team for a very long time? Have you been winning historically? Have you not been winning historically? And on and on and on. Guys, and speaking about winning and getting to finals and semifinals and racking up those trophies, and yes, yes, people will tell you it doesn't matter. Winning doesn't matter at the youth ages. Nonsense. It does matter. Now, does it actually matter when a kid turns into a professional, becomes a college D1 soccer player or something? Do they go back and think, man, that U11 trophy really changed the course of my career? Of course not. But that's not what we're talking about here. There's a lot of factors where winning is important to development, and especially the development of a coach. Because the more you win, coaches, the more credibility you gain with your players, the more credibility you gain with the parents, and the more peace and tranquility you have to work on the development side of your team and of yourselves. So how are we going to get to that state? You should go to 343coaching.com. There are free and premium programs for you there. If you've been following the 343 podcast for any length of time, consumed a lot of our freely available content, you should know, like, and trust us to this point because you know our history, you know the pioneering work that we've done in the actual game itself here in the American soccer environment. So you should join the premium program in that case. So 343coaching.com is the solution for you. Parents, I've said it a million times, I'm going to keep saying it, you are coaches as well. No, you're not laying out cones necessarily, but you are coaching your kids directly or indirectly in this game and out of this game. It all matters. How do we know? Well, we've done this stuff for over 20 years here. We've seen countless cycles of players coming through and the ultimate trajectories of all those players. So we know what works, we know what doesn't work, and we've codified that for you parents at 343masterclass.com. And for the coaches who are coaching in the 7-versus-7 environment, you go to 7v7coaching.com. All right, everybody, here we go. Enjoy this practical episode.
Coaching in big games, Gary. And what I mean by big games, semifinals, finals, whether it's, you know, State Cup final, national final, ECNL, college, high school, how do you manage those big games as a coach? How do you manage the players? I know that yourself and Brian have been involved in plenty of those big games, semifinals, finals, especially during the time of the Galaxy and the Chivas era in the DA playoffs. One that sticks to mind to me that I remember actually going to watch is, I think it was maybe 8 years ago, semifinal at the StubHub Center. It was Galaxy versus Seattle. They're losing 2-0, end up coming back, scoring two goals. Game ends 3-2 in overtime. And the biggest thing that I took away from that game, Gary, a lot of times in a big game, you'll see a team go down a goal, go down two goals, and their identity, if they do have an identity, just goes completely out the window, meaning smashing balls forward, you know, just trying to pump the ball into the box and get numbers forward, and they panic, right? But that's not what I witnessed, right? Galaxy's down 2-0. Brian makes his halftime adjustments, whatever it was, and they come back in the second half, still sticking to their identity, you know, playing out of the back, possessing the ball, and they're able to come back and win. So that was one game that really stuck out to me, but a lot that we can talk about, Gary. So let's first start with when it comes to preparing for a semifinal or for a final, as a coach, how can you best mentally prepare? You know, it's one thing to have a game plan when it comes to tactics and how you're going to defend, how you're going to attack, but how do you really get the players bought into what you're trying to do? And how do you help them mentally prepare for a big game? And especially as a young kid, right? You feel the pressure, you know, whether it's you're in the final and you're playing for an academy, maybe before the game, you start getting nervous, you feel the weight of the world. So how can you help your players mentally prepare for those types of big games?
There's no one size fits all, Benny. There's no one answer. Like all the answers and anything outside of mathematics and physics, the hard sciences, I'm going to keep repeating that phrase forever, for years to come, is it depends. Okay, it depends. For instance, if you've been coaching a team, this is the first thing that comes to mind. If you've been coaching a team for many years already, and you have established an identity and a team culture and the expectations, what they are, what they should be, and you've been successful with that identity, then the players are already bought in. They already know that they are the best and that the system works and all they have to do is execute the system. They already get it, Ben. So insofar as preparing for a semifinal, a final, quarterfinal, or whatever, it's not much different at all because we've already been successful with the system. And so it's just a matter of execution now. You don't have to really prep from the tactical perspective necessarily like everybody thinks of. It's more maybe a mental sort of thing a little bit in getting the players hyped up for the match. That's what it would be with Brian's best teams. And the game that you just mentioned against Seattle in the U.S. Soccer Development Academy semifinals, you have to remember also that Brian's team was playing 2 years up effectively. I mean, some of the players were playing 1 year up, but some, half were also playing 2 years up. So imagine at that level, I think it was that U16 or? Yeah, that was U16, I believe. I think it was U16.
I believe it was U17, U18. Semifinal.
Okay. So just imagine, right? That is a huge disparity at those ages. But irrespective, Brian had that team for many years already developing it, and the players already know Brian, respect Brian, and vice versa. So it's just a mentality thing, Benny. I wasn't there at the halftime talk, but I've been to almost all the other halftime talks throughout the course of all those years. And if the players are functioning and doing what they should be doing and that they know that they should be doing, it's a very simple halftime speech. It's just, hey guys, this is just soccer. You're doing exceptional work. Just keep at it and you're going to get the opportunities. They're going to come. Just, be maybe a little bit extra focused in front of goal to actually put the ball away. And that's it. Just keep going at them, because I don't remember that game specifically, but I would imagine like almost all our matchups, Ben, that we had most of the opportunities, but they had maybe a couple counterattacks or something or set pieces and boom, the ball goes in and there you go. Now, if it's a brand new team, which a lot of the coaches who listen to this show have, or they haven't implemented the style of play, the identity too long, then it's a little bit trickier. Then it's a little bit trickier how you prepare for that, because you as a coach are also very nervous. So I guess step number one, I know this is easier said than done. Step number one would be for the coach to try to calm himself down, because how are you going to, prepare your team aptly if you yourself are not calm? And players can sniff anxiety, nervousness, doubt from their leader, from their coach. So if you have anxiety, then the players are going to have anxiety. If you don't believe what it is that you are saying, then the players aren't going to believe what it is that you are saying. So I guess I'm saying, more than anything else, it's a mental game when it comes to knockout phases, Benny, quarters, semis, and finals, more than any tactics, more than anything else. That's where my mind went with your question.
Yeah, no, I love it. And I think you're 100% right. It really comes down to a mental game in those moments. I mean, you've seen teams that maybe on paper, they shouldn't have won, right? But with their mentality and the way that they played and the way that they showed up, they end up winning the game or the tournament or whatever it is. You mentioned, instead of kind of tactically preparing, a big thing was hyping up the players for those games. What do you mean by that? What did that look like? Is it before? Is it the morning of? A team dinner the night before? How did you hype them up?
It's the whole week leading up to the match. And I know sometimes it's tournament play, so it's not a whole week, right? It's literally like the game in the afternoon after the game in the morning. So I understand the distinction. But if you allow me to stick with the whole week sort of thing, you just have to, first off, you have to be a good psychologist. and you have to know each of the players' individual psychologies and what buttons to push with each player. So I'll give you an example from somebody that you know. His name is Carlos Hernandez. He was born 1992. He was one of our earliest players during that phenomenal run that Brian had with Orange Soccer Club Rage, that he took from the bronze level to the premier level to a national champion. So Carlitos was a D-mid, and he was quite notorious for us and for around the league for being that bulldog in central midfielder, right? Like a Gattuso type. And, you know, we would play good cop, bad cop. Brian would hype him up by saying, you're the best, you're the best, you're the best. And I would come around saying, hey, Carlos, you know, we're playing surf this weekend. Home, and I would name the guy on the other team. Homeboy's going to eat you alive. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're going to find out that, yeah, I know you think you're good, and we believe you're good, right? ODP, back when ODP was huge, youth national team, all that stuff. I'm like, but this guy, he's just different level, Carlos. He's going to run you over. And the kid was like 15 at the time. So that's the button that he needed to push, because he believed me completely and he wanted to go out there and prove me wrong. And that's what he would do. He went out there and smashed the bejesus out of this youth national team player on the other team. And then there's the collective talks. Yeah. So the collective talks throughout the course of the week during training is you hype them up by being positive more than anything and just saying you are going to run these people over and give them supreme confidence in that you're going to run these people over. Give me a second, Benny.
Yep. Savage.
Good God. Good God.
No, so Gary, so, it's really about knowing your players, right? Knowing what each individual needs and how each individual is motivated. And then it's a collective thing of, hey, we're in this together. We're going to go and we're going to smash the other team. Basically, this is what you're saying.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. You want to stay positive and hype them up like crazy throughout the week. And obviously right before the match, as soon as they arrive, like what we would do and what I think would advise anybody is try to instill a culture of supreme professionalism the moment they arrive at the field. You know, from the moment they get out of their parents' car or whatever the transportation is to when they get to the field, to the game warm-up and everything, it has to be 100% business and focus. This is not the time to be dicking around and laughing and cracking jokes and all that sort of stuff. And some people incorrectly or in a misguided fashion, that's my strong opinion, believe that, oh no, it's good if they're like laughing and having a good time and stuff because it'll lower their anxiety. I completely disagree with you. I think they need to be 100% mentally focused and have that fire, you know, focusing that fire towards the objective on the field versus being distracted. And then obviously during the warmups, make sure that the you as the coach have to sustain that. And then obviously when they're going to get on the field is you have to be a hype man. And the last thing that you should be telling them is like, go and run these people over, show them who is actually boss around here, and maybe play a couple little psychological tricks saying, look, I overheard, you know, their parents saying, oh, we're going to run these fools over. You know what I mean? Like do silly things like this. Or hey, I heard number six on the other team was just telling his homie, like, bro, this is in the bag. Like, silly things like this, because that it just works with the kids. And it's not to be deceptive or anything bad. These are nice little instruments that help the kids develop too. Because, you know, they will take that with them into the future, especially if things turn out well.
Yeah, 100%, Gary. No, I do that type of psychological warfare all the time. Like, hey, number 10 just came up to me. He said he's going to smash you or this one's going to two-foot you. And the kid gets all pissed. He's like, what? But no, many people in the audience know that I was a former player of Brian as well. And, you know, we made it to maybe four or five finals in my tenure with Brian. But that's one thing that I remember, man. You brought up the professionalism aspect. And whenever we'd show up for the warm-up of a semifinal or a final, you could just tell the energy of Brian was different in a sense of like, you guys need to be completely fucking locked in right now. Not that he wasn't like that all for all the other games, like a league game, but you could just tell like, fuck, dude, I can't, I can't be dicking around and lying right now. I need to be 100% locked in. And he just had a way of making you feel like you're playing in the World Cup final right now. Even if you're playing fucking Pat's Cup final, right? It's like, no, hey, this is a final. You need to be mentally locked in, prepared. And yeah, dude, we went to war every single time. And I know you said, right, obviously with the DA, it was a week long thing where they had a week to train and everything. But you brought it up as well that many coaches and many teams will play a weekend tournament, right? So maybe it's two games on Saturday, one game on Sunday. And then if you make it, you're in the final, right? But a big thing that I've seen, Gary, even with some of my old teams, like a big mistake that I've made is, let's say the first game on Sunday is at 10 a.m. and the final's at 3, okay? That gap in between can win or lose the final for you, bro. Because I've had players and parents, they show up to the final. I'm like, hey, you know, where'd you guys go for lunch? And the kid's like, oh, yeah, I got McDonald's. And this fool has a bag of Skittles next to him. And you walk up to the field and all the kids are running around. I'm like, what are you guys doing, bro? You know, I remember as a player, it's like, nah, if you're going to get something, you fucking get Subway. You come right back to the field, find shade and fucking get on your ass, bro. So I see it all the time, bro, where it's like teams lose tournaments because of this, Gary. Because and dude, it's not the coach's responsibility to babysit 15 kids, bro. It's the parents. It's like, let's go get a Chick-fil-A right now, you know? Or let's go get a massive fucking burrito, and then the kid can't even last 15 minutes when it comes time to the final, bro. So that's another thing that I've seen, the preparation. If it's one of those tournaments where it's like a final 3 hours later, it's like, if you're the coach, you better implement some type of rule system where all your players are just chilling and, you know, mentally preparing for the final, not dicking around, like you said.
Yeah, 100%.
Have you seen that too?
Of course. That's what happens in most circumstances, especially nowadays. I just finished recording an episode with Jimmy Obleda. We'll publish that episode before this one, so the audience will have some context. He actually gave a story about, you know, how you're able to be a better coach, like how we just finished describing in the past 10 minutes, be a better coach. You were allowed to and more capable of doing that 10, 15, 20 years ago versus today. So today it's kind of like, oh, well, what do you mean? I can't just eat whatever I want, you know, like the parents. What do you mean? Like my kid, you know, we have a 5-hour break. What do you mean you want him here 2 hours beforehand? Like, no, we're going to go chill and do whatever it is that we want to do, and that you can't be as strict. And he gave a story also of when he played in the Dallas Cup final with Fullerton Rangers against, I think it was Frankfurt, you know, obviously Bundesliga team, you know, in Dallas Cup, when Dallas Cup was the preeminent tournament, almost in the world, youth tournament in the world, almost 15 years ago. And, you know, he just gave the story of like how they were in the tunnel ready to come out to the main stadium. And the German players were kind of like shocked at how serious his Fullerton Rangers kids were and how hyped they were and how they were talking to each other. You've seen the pros talking in the tunnel at times when they're going to come out. And they're hyping themselves up and saying, we're going to fucking eat these fools alive. Let's go. Let's go. That's how the kids were. But nowadays, who's doing that? Who sees that? Is that even allowed? If like US soccer sees that happening, or MLS sees that happening, or parents sees that happening, the coach might even get in trouble for having the kids being so serious. So no, I'm dead serious. So it's a different animal nowadays, unfortunately. I still think it's possible if the coach has a lot of cachet or good reputation and good pedigree and has a lot of power and control. But that's what it takes, honestly. Honestly, that's what it takes. And that's a big shortcoming that the modern American soccer youth and pro player has in the United States, is they don't have that edge to them, Benny. They're soft, weak, because they can't mentally prepare for these sorts of things.
Yeah. No, dude, back in the day, like the example I just gave of a kid showing up and having eaten McDonald's and eating candy back in the, like, and I'm thinking about Jimmy still, like Jimmy's a fucking savage. And if a kid like that would show up I guarantee you, Jimmy's saying, all right, you're not fucking playing. You're not playing the final.
Yeah.
If you do that today, bro, you're sacked, dude. You know, the parent comes up to the director and director, you know what I mean? Like, you just can't get away with that type of stuff anymore. It's really sad, dude. But the other thing too, Gary, is that I was thinking about is a lot of teams are able to get away with that and continue to get away with that because maybe they're playing in a bracket they shouldn't be, or maybe they're just so dominant that they could show up literally fucking eating donuts the entire day and they're still going to end up smashing the team, right? And so year after year after year of doing that, they're just continuing to build bad habits, but they're getting away with it at this age because maybe they're just a dominant team like that. A lot of teams can do that.
Yeah. What's sad, Benny, is that there are exceptions for coaches and clubs, teams to be able to do what is required. For example, the MLS youth teams, they have all the power and all the control in the world to tell players how they should comport themselves and behave. And the players won't leave because they can't leave. Where are they going to go, Benny? And yet they still don't do it. On the contrary, they're among the softest in the whole country are the MLS academies. Soft, super soft. So it is a damn shame because there you have an example where you don't have to get sacked. If the franchise wants to develop savages or beasts and have that mentality of the South Americans or the Europeans where things are serious, serious, they could do it. They have all the power, Ben, and they don't do it.
Because they're not incentivized to do it.
They're not incentivized to do it. They're not incentivized to do it.
Yeah.
Quite the contrary. It's all about perception, right? And so the current American broader national climate is the right thing to do. If you're a good human, you must be a pussy. Like if you're a pussy, you're a good human. If you're not a pussy, you're not a good human. So for perception purposes, okay, well, we have to be pussies around here. Because if we're all pussies and soft, then we'll be viewed in a good light by the paying customers, by everybody. We won't get reputational damage if we're pussies. So everybody's a pussy.
Yeah. You said something to me the other day that has been like sticking in my mind is that the real ones in this game or in any industry, the real ones don't make it because they're not allowed to rise and they're not allowed to truly be themselves. They have to be a version of whatever it is that the franchise wants or the league wants. So a true coach that is passionate and knows the game and knows what he wants, he's probably not going to make it very far because if he can't conform to what the league wants and what the image or what they want the image to be. That's been sticking in my mind a lot. I'm like, dude, it's really sad.
Yeah, you're stuck in a box. You're stuck in a box and there's no competition of ideas, Benny. It'd be great if there was an open competition of ideas because you can have hey, you want to be a pussy? Cool, be a pussy. Oh, hey, you want to be serious and hardcore? Cool, you're allowed to be serious and hardcore. And then at the end of the day, let's see who comes out on top. Let's see who develops the best players. Let's see who makes it the furthest on a team perspective, on a club perspective, on a player perspective. But there's no competition of ideas. No. The law of the land is you must be a pussy. And so everybody's a pussy.
I'm going to make sure it's just MLS on the front. And then on the back, it says you must be a pussy.
I thought you were going to actually put like a graphic image.
There you go. That could help too. So Gary, you mentioned, okay, there's a lot of times when you have, let's say 3 or 4 days or even a week to prepare for semifinal, final. What do those training sessions look like? And how do you tailor it so that you're able to replicate match intensity or match moments, but at the same time, you don't want the players to be fatigued, right? When it comes time for the weekend. So were those sessions more kind of like walkthroughs of attacking patterns, set pieces? Maybe you already had film of the other team and you have the 11 subs are lining up like them. Like what did those sessions look like leading up to a big game?
Yeah. First and foremost, not much by the way of film session, because look, let's be realistic. Film only came into the picture maybe in the last, let's say 10 years. Okay. But when I say film came into the picture in the last 10 years, not really. I mean, the games are filmed, but the filming is trash. Okay. It's trash. It's not like film of Division One professional soccer in Europe, you know, where you can sit down and you have all the different angles and you can analyze and you can cut and you can show. Youth soccer filming in this country up until this day is garbage. My filming, when we first like pioneered this whole thing with a high pod system and all that 15, 20 years ago, my filming from 15, 20 years ago is 100,000 times superior still to this day than what you see filmed today, Benny, because I mean, let's not go down this rabbit hole. So you want us to focus on preparation. So no film really, for the most part.
Let me interject you right there though, because
go ahead.
Let me interject you because even if there was no film, I know given the opportunity and given the chance, if Ryan was able to watch the team play beforehand, like he would be there on the sideline. So let's say they
I was getting there. So what I was going to say, there's no film, but there was scouting. That was literally my next phrase. Scouting, okay. Either I scouted, Brian scouted, John Esham scouted, somebody scouted, but it had to be principally either Brian or myself because, you know, we see things a certain way. And, you know, we figure out the strengths and weaknesses of the opponent. I think that is probably the most impactful thing. You don't have to know everything. You don't have to know, oh, they play 4-4-2, diamond midfield, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, we would be aware of these sorts of things, of course, but it's kind of like, who is their one badass player? Who is their one most dangerous player? Maybe two. And who is their one or two or three troncos, terrible players on the field, but mostly the badass player. So let's just shut that guy down. If he is a supreme badass, then it's kind of like, okay, man marking sort of thing. That eliminates a youth player. You wouldn't even believe, or maybe you do know it already, but at the youth level, if you decide to man mark somebody, that player is eliminated from the game. They have no way out of that. They don't know how to handle it. So that would be preparation, Benny. Set pieces were a huge thing leading up to these sorts of games. And then yes, a walkthrough of, you know, either building out or how we're going to attack, but not intense training whatsoever, Ben. Set pieces were huge. I got to say like half the session might be set pieces.
Yeah. And was it offensive and defensive or more of a primary on the offensive set pieces?
Primary on the offense. I would say 75% offensive, 25% defensive. And on the defensive side, honestly, it's either we're marking in zone or we're marking man marking. It's just one or the other principally. And then it's more of a hype session too, so that they're focused when we do have to defend a set piece, right? And we elevate like animals and get the ball the F out of there. So it's more of a hype session for defensive stuff and more like serious science for the offensive stuff.
Going back to when you said that you guys would go and scout the games, right? I was just thinking, fucking, you send Esham to one of the games and he's coming back with fucking shocking nuts, bro. But I know he's like, mark this player and, you know, compete your balls off. That was his nut.
Right.
But you said you also identified who are their worst players. Okay, so what would you do with that information? Was it like, hey, let's set traps to funnel the ball to those players, or let's press them as soon as this fool gets the ball? Like, what did you do with that information of, hey, their left back is the worst player on the field by far?
No, totally. It's either set traps, maybe off of their goal kicks or even off the run of play, to make sure that their left back is the guy on the ball most of the time because he's terrible. And or coupled with, okay, the left back is shocking defensively or is weak or is slow or doesn't know how to play. Let's maybe get our most dangerous winger there. So we might even invert the winger just so that we can do tremendous damage up that side.
All right. So Gary, you win the semifinal, you're on to the final, all the preparation's done, you know, pregame speech done in the game. Okay. As a coach, does anything change or do you keep it the same, or do you need to bring more energy, more intensity? more coaching points. Because if you think about it, the first 10, 15 minutes of a final, the players are nervous, dude. And you can see it in their first touch and their decision-making. So do you help them out a little bit more in those moments? Like, you know that they're feeling pressure. So does your coaching style have to change?
I think so a little bit. You have to play it by how you feel, right? As a coach, what do you feel in the moment? It's hard to describe, Benny. Do you feel that your players are a little bit on edge, right? If that's what you feel, then I go with what you just said. You be a soothing voice on the sideline, be a calming presence on the sideline. Like, hey guys, we're good. Just, hey, as soon as they get a turnover, we get the ball, just make sure you connect your first pass. Just make sure you connect your first pass. That's all. And that'll get us into a rhythm, you know, and you speak with them with this sort of tone, very soft, very fluid. And once they start settling into the game and they start connecting and doing well, then again, you have to feel it. Then you can shift, you know, your tone if you want to be a little bit more intense, because now those nerves have kind of gone away. And the opposite has also occurred, Ben, where, for instance, if we're overmatched, which has happened in the past, then from the get-go, you want to instill insane energy into the players. You know, from the opening whistle, you are animated as the coach on the sideline. Go, let's go. Like the horse race just, you know, opened the gates and the horses are off to the races, right? So it's super intense. In the very beginning. And then you kind of cruise as the horse goes through the quarter mile and the half mile. It's just cruise control, seeing the lay of the land. Okay, how are things playing out? And then in the last quarter mile, it's the last parts of the game, depending on how things are going, or the last part of the half. Okay, you crack the whip again on the horse. Crack, crack, crack. And, you know, to get to the end line. So it's a feeling, Benny, but I think maybe that analogy is kind of helpful.
It is very helpful. So you said that there were some times when you guys were overmatched, meaning, mm-hmm. you know, the other team has better players, you know, their quality is better. Maybe they're bigger and faster, stronger because you're playing up. Did the identity change, or was it still, hey, no, we're still going to fucking stick true to who we are. We're still going to possess. We're still going to try and build out of the back. Like, or did it have to be like, hey, let's try and play a little bit more direct today. Cause if we try and build out or play, we're fucked.
Yeah. Depends on the context. I know our context for this discussion is tournament play, and you're like in a semifinal or final even. If you're overmatched, then, I mean, don't be stupid. You want to try to play to win also. And even though you might have your identity firmly established and you're very good at it, if you as a coach deem that doing this, we're dead, they're going to kill us for whatever reason, okay, then adapt your style of play, but don't adapt on the fly there in the game. You have to rehearse it before playing that match. You have to rehearse it, Benny. So for instance, if we want to shift from being a possession-based attacking-oriented team where we are in control and attack, to bunkering because we're super overmatched, well, you have to train the team how to bunker. And we would, Ben, we would. Even if the games are a tournament game where you're playing two games in a weekend or something like that, we would think ahead of time. If we think that we had a probability or possibility of going up against a team at some point in the semi or the final that is will overpower us during the week, we will train how to bunker and counter. We'll train it. And then we'll do it in the match. And it doesn't have to be from the opening whistle. Because I'll tell you, many a times the strategy when we were overmatched, Ben, was shock and awe. Shock and awe. We got that phrase from the Iraq War, right? Because that was the phrasing that the U.S. government would use. It's like in the beginning whistle, you go balls out, go after them, even if you're overmatched. And let's see if we can get a quick one, you know, for in the first 5 or 10 minutes or 15 minutes, and see if we can shock them, right? And maybe squeeze a goal in. And then we'll get into our little turtle shell and pick our moments as to when to go. We would never usually bunker from the opening whistle, almost never. It was always go crazy in the beginning, see if we can get one, and then bunker. And if we don't get one in the first 5, 10, 15 minutes, we'll still start getting into our turtle shell and bunkering, because we can't sustain that sort of energy for 70 minutes, 80 minutes, 90 minutes, however long the matches are. Did that make sense? Have you run across those sorts of games with us?
100% I have. I mean, I've lived those games myself with Brian, and even watching Danny's teams. And that, bro, like, there was a lot of times, and because obviously Danny's team started from nothing, right? And they worked their way up. But along the way, along the path, they've made it to finals, and we're just playing teams that had been around for, I don't know, 7 years. And you could just tell, right? But like you said, like you brought up Carlos, bro, this whole, like, the first play of the game, this fool's going in for a 2-foot tackle for, like, yellow card first play of the game. But you can tell, like, these guys are just fucking ready to go to war, dude. That was one thing that Brian was really good at, is that his players are willing to fucking die on the field for him, you know? So I have a kind of a two-parter question, Gary, going back to the psychology of the players. When you know as a coach that your team is outmatched, you know you're facing a superior team, how can you instill in the players a sense of belief that it is possible to win this game? And then on the other end of it, when you know that you're the superior team, how can you get your play? Because what happens a lot of time is, especially within the youth game, a team is by far the better team. And so when they show up for the game, they're already thinking in their head, hey, we won the game. This is going to be easy. It's going to be a walk in the park. And it's not the case like that, you know? So two sides of the coin. One, if you're not the better team, how do you help your players to believe, like, hey, this is possible? And then number two, you are. How do you kind of ground your players a little bit and make them say, like, no, you still have to go and fucking execute to the highest caliber today?
Yeah, Benny, what comes to mind is people want a recipe, meaning question, okay, Gary, give us the recipe. And unfortunately, in things like coaching, it's an art. And what I mean by art and leadership means you have to be a charismatic leader. Now, how can you teach somebody to have charisma and actually be able to lead and have other human beings believe in you when you tell them that we are going to win this game, or we are going to compete, or we have a legitimate chance? You can't. I don't know how to teach that, Ben. It just comes out naturally. Or if you want to eventually get to that, if you don't currently have it, you have to practice it. And I know I've given coaches advice before that, hey, don't be shy. Practice your speeches in the mirror, in the bathroom, by yourself, you know, on a daily or weekly basis, and just start programming yourself so that you flow with your chats, because you have to believe it yourself that you have a shot. Otherwise, your players aren't going to believe it. So charisma is key, Ben. That's why some coaches are great and other coaches not so great, and other coaches not good at all, you know, because they're just stoic, non-charismatic leaders. Fortunately, Brian has that in his blood. Fortunately, some coaches like Jimmy Oblitha have that in their blood. Fortunately, in my little niche, maybe I have some of that in my blood. So I don't know. I think it's very helpful if you have a track record with your players, that you've gotten results with your players in the past. When you've been outmatched and you've whipped out a result, you won. Or you whipped out a result, maybe you drew, but that's a good result. Or maybe you lost that game, but your players come off the field knowing that, oh shit, we competed. We could have had them, and it's a superior opponent. So sometimes players have you experienced that, Benny, where you lose a game against a superior opponent where everybody knew their superior opponent, but your players themselves come off the match kind of proud of themselves, kind of proud of themselves, like, man, like, I didn't think we were actually going to compete and only lose 1-0 or 2-1 or go to PKs or get so close. So I guess what I'm saying is having a track record with your players obviously helps.
Got it. And I guess on the other end of it is, oh, like, the other, yeah. I mean, basically the same thing, right? You have to have the charisma. You have to be able to help your players be locked in and not be thinking like, no, you guys didn't fucking win the game already. You still have to show up. You still have to compete, you know?
And it's hard, Ben, because we weren't masters of that either. I'm sure if you ask Brian, you'll say the same thing. When we were playing inferior opponents, I think that's even a more difficult coaching job to have your players operate at their peak efficiency when you're playing somebody inferior than if you're playing somebody superior. I think in that case, it's easier to have them operate at 100. Our players would always operate like a 70, 80. You know, if it was 90% and we were playing somebody inferior, wow, you know, we're proud of ourselves. You know, the players really went out and balled out. But it's like almost never 100%. They will, it's like human instinct. They will naturally take plays off, right?
Yeah.
So like if our striker loses the ball and the other team now has possession and, you know, advances or something, if we're superior, our striker will be like, my boys will shut that down. It's fine. Like, I don't have to chase after, you know what I mean? Like, it just happens. It pisses us off and I'll scream on the sidelines and maybe the player will re-engage, but they did shut off and they do shut off.
Yeah. One moment can change the game, bro. If the striker pressed right there and won the ball, he goes to goal. That could be the game. But even I myself have been guilty of that. And I think if you, the coach, have that mentality, I think your players can sense it and it kind of rubs off on them. And so what I mean by that is like, okay, hey, on paper, we're supposed to win this final 5-0, you know? So when the game starts naturally, I'm not going to be like, if we were playing fucking the number one team in the country, I wouldn't be like, hey, you know, rallying up the players. It's more like, I'll still give coaching points, but bro, we're going to win 5-0, you know? And then all of a sudden it's like they score a goal. And so I think if you as a coach are guilty of that, your players are going to sniff it out right away. And well, if coach isn't operating at 100%, why do I have to be doing that today? You know what I mean? And
yeah,
big lesson that I had to learn is like, fuck dude, you can't take any game off. Doesn't matter who you're playing.
Yeah. That reminds me of us giving them even objectives when we knew that we were up against a vastly inferior team and we're going to win. We're just going to win. Okay. It doesn't matter. We're going to win the game. We would come up with objectives. Hey, the objective is to, we better win at least 7-0 this game. Otherwise, we're pissed. Otherwise, you don't want to come to training that week. You guys are in massive trouble. So, something like that. You know, I'm thinking on the fly right here. So the players would go out gangbusters from the very beginning because they didn't want to get into the second half of the match or later stages of the game, and it's only 3-0. You know what I mean? Like, oh shit, now we have to score 3 or 4 or 5 goals to meet our objective. So we would set things like that, or we would set objectives to our strikers or wingers. Hey, you better score 2 goals this game or there's going to be consequences. So they're like, oh shit, like I have to do something about this. Or our keeper or back line. If they score on us, bro, Big problems.
They're coming out there feeling like, fuck, Gary's going to be pissed.
Serious.
That's hilarious. No, I get what you're saying. All right, let me ask you this, Gary. You're winning 1-0, 15 minutes left in the final. Do you park the bus or do you look to get the second goal?
It depends. We've had good and bad experiences doing both things. Man, that's a good question. It's a very difficult question, Benny. And I struggle with it because I think you have to be there in the game, in the context of the game, and then see what you feel, man, and see what your gut is telling you. Because, and people are going to think I'm crazy and I don't care. It's fine. When you've seen so much football and you've coached so much and you know your team so well, deeply, deeply, and you know the other team very well, you can almost see the future. It's very weird. It's very weird. You can almost see the future. You can almost smell when you're in massive trouble that it's only a matter of time and they're going to score on you. You can smell that. And, you know, if you can smell it, then you have to make adjustments. You say, okay, this is not good. Bunker, or we go 5 in the back, 5-3-2, or whatever. Load up the midfield, take out a striker, put another guy in the midfield, and just hang on for dear life to the very end because you smell it, okay? And And some people might think, and you're just talking out of your ass, you're just philosophizing here out of theory and hypotheticals. You start thinking, oh, well, see, that's when you make the mistake, and that's when they actually end up scoring because you get into a defensive posture and now they're all on top of you. No, no, guys, like it, you just don't understand. We've lived the other side of the coin too, where we're up a goal, like how you said, and we're like, we're playing good. Don't change a goddamn thing. Like, why do you change what's already working? You know, and there's 15 minutes left and it's happened to us. And the other team either just gets a counterattack, gets inspired, or gets a set piece or something and puts it into the mixer and boom, 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 you know, there's a goal. And then all of a sudden the other team is inspired and the momentum's on their side and they have belief. And we're like, oh my God, like not us, our players. Oh my God, we just blew it. We had it in the bag. You know, there was only 10 minutes to go. And now you're all in your head and the other team's all on top of you, Benny, on top of you. On top of you. And if you switch it up there to bunker to do something else, then your players are even more self-conscious. Like, oh man, coach and everybody's saying we're fucked. That's why he's changing versus changing when we're not fucked. We're actually in the lead. That's a different psychology that exists versus, oh man, you know, we're fucked. Now let's change. So I don't know how to answer the question, Benny. It has to be in the moment. You have to feel it. And then you make a decision. One more thing. So in those moments where we blew it because we didn't change and we thought, oh, everything's going great. We're doing the stuff. And we end up like losing the game. Early in the coaching careers, right, Brian and myself, you reflect and you're like, what could you have done different? What could you have changed? You know, and we just started thinking about, okay, we need to have kind of a contingency plan, hypothetical. If these are the circumstances of the game, during these minutes or whatever, this is how these are the changes that we're making. Like we almost like an algorithm, almost like a trigger, and you strip the emotion out of it, right? So if we're winning 1-0, we're winning 1-0, 15 minutes left against an equal opponent, a decent opponent or better opponent, instant flip. We're going 5-3-2 and whatever, and bunker. But we've also done that in the past. And then it doesn't quite work out really. And then you start reflecting, you're saying, that's so dumb. Why would you have rules set in stone and take the emotion out of it? Like that's really dumb because we actually know football and football has, there's a lot of feeling to football. There's a lot of pattern recognition to football. There's a lot of context associated with football. That's so dumb that you would have just a rule that you're just going to execute this rule under certain circumstances. Dumb. So I think it's more of a by feel sort of thing, Benny, ultimately. Yeah. But you have to go through this evolution, I think, as a coach, right? In the very beginning, it's kind of emotional. You don't know what you're doing. You're experimenting. And then stage two, you come up with rules because now you have some experience and you don't want to have those experiences again, or you want to replicate the good experiences. You kind of make rules as to how you're going to behave. And then after a long period of time, you see even more and you have more experience and more pattern recognition. And then you circle back all the way back to the beginning where it's emotion driven. So now you're so dialed into football. You know so much that it's not a purely objective thing. It's like your nervous system feels what should change and what's wrong and what's right.
Yep. So many things I want to say. First of all, when you talk about like this algorithm or this like, you know, having a contingency plan of what to do, that makes me think of like, if you think about like the NFL or college football, like those guys are the masters of those types of scenarios. Like at training, they always run like a 2-minute drill, right? And hey, if we're down by this many, we're running this exact play. Or if there's 30 seconds left and we're going to set up this way. And it's like, I think soccer is different in the sense that the game is continuous and you have to continue to fill out the moments of the game, right? And the reason I ask you about the, you know, hey, 1-0, you're winning, 15 minutes left, right? You were there at the final that I was in last year. I have a fucking plaque right here to my left that says finalist on it. Doesn't say champion. It's hard to look at. Literally up 1-0. And I personally felt like everything's going our way. We're creating chances. Why are we going to sit back? And sure enough, they got the one goal, and it's just that one goal in a final, Gary, is, especially when you have a big fan base there, massive momentum for the other team, massive. And it's just so hard because after that, brother, they are just all over you, bro. But to your point about, you know, feeling it out and we know the game, it's like, you don't know until after what, you know, what you should have done. Like this literally happened a year ago and I'm still thinking like to this day, like, fuck, should I have moved this player to right back or should I have thrown one more in the middle or should we have sat? You know what I mean? Like you will never stop thinking about it. But on the other end, it's like, yeah, if we push and got that goal, then yeah, this shit would say fucking champion right here and everything would be great, you know, but you can't get those moments back, but it helps you to grow and learn as a coach too.
So by accident, I ended up describing your situation.
I'm like, oh fuck, I forgot Gary was there.
That's not what I was thinking. I was actually thinking of a National Cup quarterfinal or semifinal against Arsenal. That's what I was thinking of 15 years ago.
But it just goes to show you, I mean, it's not just myself, it's not just Brian. I mean, this happens to thousands of teams all over the country every single weekend.
Of course.
Up 1-0.
And you can't second guess yourself, Benny, because again, you don't know what the alternate universe had in store. You don't know. Because you could have changed, you could have bunkered and tried to hang on for dear life, and they could have thrown it into the mixer and scored. And then you would be sitting there right now with your finalist plaque saying, I'm so stupid. We were doing good. We had the game under control. That was the dumbest mistake on planet Earth. I'm never doing that again.
Yeah, no, for sure. I'd still be here thinking, but just, I'd be feeling like, fuck, I'm even more of an idiot that I did change it. First, it's like, hey, no, I stuck to my belief. I felt like we were going to get the goal and didn't work out. But you know, that's the way the game goes, dude. And I always tell people, like, that was my first year as the head coach of the team, right? If I would have won that year, I'm like, I'm happy to retire anytime. But now it's like, I can't retire until I make it back to that game and fucking seal the deal. As insignificant as it is, it's like, I don't know, dude. You feel that desire to want to compete and want to be successful.
Yeah, unfortunately, in high school, you don't have much power over your player personnel.
True. I would like to run an experiment, though, of, like, from freshman year, like, you take, let's say, the Froshtop team, like, the lowest level of kids, right? Implement the 3-4-3 methodology, and, hey, let's see where they're at by their senior year. I'll let you know how that goes in 4 years. I'm on year one of a four-year plan, so I'll let you know how it goes, Gary. But
all right,
I don't know about you, but I love finals, bro. I really do. Like the anticipation leading up to it in the game, even like after the game, you know, obviously I didn't win that one, but I've been a part of many finals that I have won. It's just, I don't know. There's no better feeling to me, like in the game and before the game is better than after, because like after the game, it's like, all right, you won, but like now what? I think I think it was the Argentinian like assistant coach or somebody from Argentina is like, what is even the point of winning the World Cup? Like, yeah, we won, but like now what? Something like, I'll have to find that video and send it to you. But what is the most memorable final that you were a part of in the era of you and Brian? And while you think on that, I do remember, I think it was the final versus New York. And I think, can't remember the score, but what I do remember from that game is that one of the players got like a yellow card, and then all of a sudden, like New York was like screaming at the ref, and the ref goes over and like does like a VAR type thing, even though back then VAR didn't exist, and ultimately ended up screwing up the game. Do you remember that? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think that might be one of the more memorable ones because it's one of the more recent ones. From the youth perspective anyway, and the higher profile ones. So for the audience sake, you know, Brian was, you know, took his team, which was playing at Galaxy at the time, to the U18 Development Academy final. Again, I think playing a year up, or was it? Yes, I think so. Or roughly against New York City FC, and a lot of future pros on that field, right? So on our side, it was Efrain Alvarez, Alex Mendez, Jorge Hernandez, Leo Sepulveda, you know, left center back who's at Chivas now also. And then on the other side, they had Gio Reyna, they had Justin Hack, they had James Sands, you know, who's playing in Germany also. So kind of like a Clash of the Titans sort of thing. Yeah, it's pretty memorable because it was so intense. I think it went all the way to PKs, and we've always had bad luck in PKs, kind of like Mexico has bad luck in PKs. And a lot of our players are Mexican-American, so imagine that. And yeah, the incident that you said was a very curious one. We never really got answers to. So one of the New York players ended up, and we were drawn at the time, and there was plenty of game time left. One of the New York players, you know, ended up getting a red card for something, you know, some sort of violent action. And, you know, the kid, ref had given a red card. The kid had gone out of the field, you know, and play was about to resume. And then somebody like from U.S. Soccer kind of stopped the game, you know, and like there was like a conference meeting that happened that lasted like, I don't know, like 10 minutes or something. And they were in like a booth because it was like in one of those high school sort of stadium sort of things. And they went up to like the camera booth up there, whatever. And, you know, 5, 7, 10 minutes later, somehow the red card got reversed. First off, there was no VAR. There were no rules for this sort of stuff or anything. Somehow the red card got reversed and the player comes back on the field. And, you know, the game ended the way it ended. You know, we ended up losing in PK. So extremely controversial, extremely shady. They definitely didn't want us to win. That was very clear for a very long time. And yeah, so that made it a little bit extra memorable then. But I was on the other side of the field, which is also very helpful, especially, you know, if people want advice here too, from a coaching perspective, if you have an assistant coach, it'd be good if the head coach is on one side, the assistant coach is on the other. And then you have very close range dialogue capabilities with your players, right? Because you're on both sides of the field. And I remember kind of yelling quite a bit during that match. And in particular, I remember one moment where I, you know, gave Efra a little yell because he was like being lazy or walking around like, Efra, we never win a goddamn thing around here. Because a year prior when we were playing 2 years up, we lost in the final against FC Dallas. You know, again, I have to emphasize we were playing 2 years up, Benny, right? But we still lost and it still hurts. So here we were in this intense game and I was smelling it, right? How I said a moment ago, I was smelling something not quite right, not quite good. We had missed all these opportunities. We hit the post. Diving headers, you should have with wide open net, missing them. And like, this doesn't smell good. And so I gave a little yell here or there. One was to Efra. It's like, Efra, we never win a fucking final around here. Let's go. But yeah, you know, after the match is over and they're very intense, it's a huge emotional release. Even if you lose, Benny, it's like you've had adrenaline coursing through your veins for 90 minutes and then it seeps out of your body and you're close to collapsing, dude. You feel numb.
Yeah. What did those team talks after a final loss, what would that look like?
Short, very short. Never getting down on the players at all. Always exhibiting pride in your players. Lifting them up because this is one of their worst moments. So you lift them up. Again, you lead them with your head held high. And you're like, hey, this is all part of the process. This isn't the end of the road. You have a long future ahead of yourselves, long career, whether it be professional, whether it be something else. And we get back to work next week. You know, I'll see you then. Done.
That's
even,
it.
Even if they had played like shit. Yeah. You say those things. Well, yeah. And if they play like shit, it's like, hey, we'll talk more about it, you know, and, you know, next week, enjoy, you know, your time with your family, with your friends, you know, have a good dinner, sleep well, take care of your bodies, and we'll see you next week.
Yeah. And you address it at training next week and in a positive way, right? Continue building their confidence.
Totally.
Yeah. All right, Gary, penalties, bro. I know you just said you guys had a lot of bad luck over the years, and not just with the Galaxy Academy, but even like going all the way back to some of Brian's first teams. Like, I remember so many finals where they were losing PKs. Couple questions. One is, does Brian already have a list of players, top five, that are going to shoot before the game? Or is it an in the game or after the game decision based on who's playing well?
Let me give it percentages. We have to follow up with him because he has better memory, obviously, because he actually wrote it all down. I would say 80% is fixed almost permanently, and then the other 20% is open for discussion, you know, in the match. And with respect to what's open and what's fixed, what's open has to be settled and determined before the end of the match. So you're already thinking 5 or 10 minutes, maybe before the end of the match, who's taking the PKs. I don't think, man, you're putting me on the spot here, Benny. It's hard to remember. I don't think we were sitting there after the ref had blown the whistle and start debating, okay, who's taking PKs. I think that's usually a mistake.
I sent you this like kind of research on the 2022 World Cup, and am I muted? No. And it's from this guy, he's a sports mentality psychologist or whatever, and he looked at all the penalty shootouts from every game in the World Cup, and what he found was that the managers that gave the instructions the quickest, meaning like, hey, here's their five shooters, those teams went on to win every penalty shootout. So it was Canada versus Japan, Canada won. Let me see. Croatia versus Japan. Morocco, Spain, Morocco wins. All of the matches. And there's even a clip you see in the final. You see Scaloni like right after the game. He's like, hey, you're taking one. And like within 20 seconds, Gary, and okay, everybody already knows. And then you see on the other side, you see Deschamps like, this fool has no idea who's going to take one. He's like looking around. He looks all nervous, right? And basically what the guy was saying is that like the players can sense your own lack of confidence, or if you don't have a plan, it rubs off on the players, right? And so I think it makes sense, dude. Like, that. So in our playoff run last year that we had, we went to PKs twice, and I had actually seen this research. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to try it. So literally, bro, no less than a minute that I spend like, hey, here's the order. Have confidence, go and execute. I tried it both times and we ended up winning both of the games, you know? So I'm not saying that this is like the end all be all. If you give your list within 30 seconds, you're going to win. But something to think about as a coach, right? You definitely don't want to have insecurity or like feel like, you know, who wants to take one? Like, do you want to take one? Like, I think that right there will rub off on the players. Like there was, he also in the thread of the Twitter, right? He showed Japan's coach, and Japan style is like, all right, who wants to volunteer to take a penalty? And it took him like 3 or 4 minutes to like decide like, oh, like, should I take one or not? And sure enough, they ended up losing that game, you know? So obviously, again, it's not like scientific, like, hey, if you spend less time, you're going to win, but something to think about there. No, Gary?
Yeah, I think there's a logic to it. And having played myself and having coached and seeing a lot of the psychology, I think it's probably a good way to go, Ben. You eliminate doubt from the players' minds and you eliminate your own doubt as well. And it's a lot more comfortable in that regard. And I think when you're going to go do a high pressure thing, you don't want to have doubt in your mind. You just want to go and be like a robot and just like, okay, here, this is my responsibility. Let me just take it. And what the universe wants to happen happens. It's out of my control. But the moment you start asking players, do you want to take a PK? You've put things in their control, which fucks with the human mind. You know, it's like, oh, now I control whether I take one or I don't take one. And so now I have the responsibility when I take the PK because I chose to take the PK versus no, my leader, my coach told me I'm taking one, I'm third in line, and that's the end of story. And okay, I guess I have to go take the PK, you know, and if I miss, it's on my coach. They're not thinking that necessarily, it's on my coach, but there's a little, I would say, subconscious element to it, perhaps, that it's not all on you and on your shoulders. And as a coach, you probably want to assume all the responsibility and take all the responsibility away from the players.
True. What would be, because I know for some tournaments and some finals before the PKs, like maybe you go up to a player, like you go up to Efra. What do you say to a player in that moment? Is it A, like trust yourself, have confidence, or?
Don't say shit.
Like what do you say?
For taking a PK?
For taking a PK, yeah. If a player comes up to you and it's like, oh, fucking Gary, I'm nervous, dude. Like, what are you telling?
Oh, I would say, hey, you want to be a soccer player? It's all good, man. You're going to take 1,000 PKs in your future. So this is another moment for you to have an experience so that the next 999 PKs, you have this one PK under your belt, you know? So go up there and execute. You're good.
Mean ass speech for I take a PK. Let me say.
Is that not true?
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. I remember like one thing that I hate is like when you see a player do like a massive run up, a couple shifts to the side, and then they end up like shanking it. Like even my brother Nick, they were in a final for a tournament. They would go to PKs. This guy was literally the last shooter. And I've never seen him do this before, but like he lines up like outside of the box, like 10 yards away, starts running, makes a sign of the cross. He like touches the floor, does a sign of the cross before he shoots. And then this little fucking shanks it, bro, like into the bleachers, bro. I'm like, dude, just fucking get up there. But here's the thing, Gary. It's like at training, I think you need to like execute your PK like 50 times the same exact way that you're going to do it in the game. Don't change it at the last second, or, you know, even if you are going to do one of those fancy run up type things, like actually train it before you get to the game. So it's not the first time that your body is going through this, right? It's, I don't know, before every session ends or before you leave, 20 PKs, and it should be in the same spot every single time.
Yeah.
Speaking of
preparation for finals or playoff games. Yeah. Brian would always have them shooting PKs at the end of training sessions, for sure.
Yeah. Was it like competition, like, hey, this group versus this group, or everybody just goes and takes their own PK?
I think it was everybody takes their own.
Yeah. Fuck, bro, all this talk, I want to get back to a final myself.
Good for you. I'm glad I'm out of that.
Yeah, I know you don't care, but.
No, I'm out of that scene. All good. I'll go watch you, Benny. I hope you get to a final so I can go watch again.
We're going to have to bring up, or maybe not soon, but maybe 3 or 4 years down the line, that whole game, you said, right? It was clear that they didn't want you to win. We might have to uncover a little bit of why that happened. It doesn't have to be soon, but that's corrupt right there, bro. That's corrupt.
Oh, you don't know the half of it, man. It's really bad, nasty.
How pissed were you and Brian though, after the game?
You can only control what you can control, man. But it was very clear. And, you know, a lot of people in the community came up to Brian after that match in the parking lot and kind of, you know, to the side kind of said like, hey, dude, what they fucking did to you is fucking just, that's fucked up. Like, people knew. It's so blatant, dude. It's so blatantly obvious. The ref had given a red card, and the player left, and everybody had accepted it. The other coach had accepted it. It was all accepted. It was accepted. And then all of a sudden, whoa. People with the U.S. soccer badge came out of nowhere.
Did the game start again before he went back on the field?
Yeah, I don't remember, Ben. I goddamn don't remember. I do not remember.
Because also, if that's the case, dude, then it's like, wow.
I don't remember, man.
That is insane. I'm going to look it up, but they probably took that video down from YouTube. Because you know how back then they had all the games on there.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point, man. Yeah, you should look it up. And if it's still there, make sure you download it before they listen to this episode. Because then they'll take it off for sure.
All right, Gary. Any parting advice? Let's say a coach, they're listening to this and they have a final tomorrow. What are you saying to them?
I don't know. Be calm. Take it all in. You'll make good memories, whether win, lose, or draw. And just like you asked me for what advice I would give Efra for taking a PK, it's the same advice. You know, you're going to have another 1,000 games coaching in the future, and maybe not that many finals, admittedly. Okay, but you're still going to have more finals, hopefully, in the future. Just, you know, take this one in as experience, man. And even the greats lose finals. It happens all the time. So don't beat yourself up too much if it doesn't go your way. It's football.
Did you cry when Argentina lost to Germany in the World Cup final?
No, I have never cried over football, Benny.
Really?
Yeah, not once, not a single time.
Not even like tears of joy?
No. Look, I got a little emotional when Argentina won the World Cup, and I think it's because of everything surrounding Messi. It wasn't about Argentina winning. It was about Messi, you know, kind of fulfilling the prophecy sort of thing. You know what I mean? Because nobody knew whether the prophecy would be fulfilled, right? That the greatest, you know, would complete football and finish football by winning this trophy. And for a decade, you know, especially after he lost the final against Germany two cycles prior, there's so much buildup around it. And so when it actually happened, yeah, I got a little emotional. But again, it's because of those reasons. But other than that, zero times, Ben. Zero.
Yeah. I just saw something. I think it's probably like, I couldn't tell if it was AI or not, but it was like, yeah, like Ronaldo before the last World Cup final, like this fool went to church and was praying that like Messi wouldn't win because
it's AI, bro.
I was like, dude, this shit, but it's getting hard to tell. It's getting hard to tell.
Yeah.
It wasn't him like at church praying, but it was like a clip of him saying like, oh yeah, you know, before the game, I went to church. And I was like, dude, people have too much time on their hands, bro.
Remember that kid from Argentina that I brought up a handful of podcasts ago, that he's like a savant at football. He knows everything about everything in soccer. He's like 22 years old now or something like that. He's a streamer, super popular, millions of followers. I came across a reel, have to inject it here, tell you, and we'll end with this, Ben, where they ask him, hey, they give him two scenarios, right? One scenario is 2026 World Cup final, you know, it's Argentina versus Portugal. It's 1-1, corner kick, Portugal, you know, 30 seconds to go or something like that. Homeboy serves it up into the box. Ronaldo elevates over everybody, right? 2-1. And there's 30 seconds left. They line it up. They kick the ball off. Referee says, game over. Portugal wins. Ronaldo gets his World Cup trophy. Scenario one. Scenario two. And then he paints a similar type picture, right? It's almost to the end against and it's Argentina versus Mexico in the final. And then like Mexico wins in the World Cup. Like which of the two are you picking? Which one would you accept more? And he's like, oh, without question, Ronaldo. Ronaldo fucking winning. And so it's weird for an Argentinian to say that. Okay. It's interesting, right? Because Messi's the GOAT. And what he has that is indisputable. He, even without the World Cup, it's indisputable for almost everybody in the world except people who don't know football. Okay. But even for people who don't know football, because Messi has the World Cup, it's indisputable. He's the guy, not Ronaldo. But now Ronaldo gets one, a World Cup. So now us Argentinians, everybody has to put up with the bullshit that Ronaldo. But look, he chooses that future over Mexico. Because he's like, no, man, if Mexico, like you can't have like a trash. That you can't have Mexico winning the World Cup, man. That's just something that's you can't have a universe where that happens. You can't do that. It's just wrong, and you have to put up with nonsense from Mexicans.
I feel like every South American country hates every other South American country. Have you noticed that? Like Argentinians, for example, like they hate fucking Mexico, or Mexicans hate fucking Guatemalans, or whatever it is, dude. Have you noticed that or no?
No, it's not true, Benny. It's not true.
Like, what is the beef between Argentina and Mexico?
There is no beef. Mexico has the beef. You believe, this is funny. This is another funny thing. Mexico has created this aura as if there's some sort of rivalry between Mexico and Argentina. And it's because you live in the United States and you have Mexican friends and a lot of Mexican Americans are here and everything. And you see reels and you see stuff and online that there's this rivalry between Mexico and Argentina and they hate each other or something. That's all Mexican driven. Argentinians, we don't even think about Mexico. Like, who is Mexico? What rivalry? What are you talking about? There's no rivalry here. What on earth are you people talking about? There's no rivalry. We don't even think about you. So it's all a Mexican made thing. And like, we like Mexicans. The Argentinians, they like Mexicans. Mexicans don't like Argentinians because they see it as this sort of thing, right?
Maybe it's just Mexicans then, because I always hear them saying like, and they're 100% Mexican, like moved to the U.S. from Mexico. They're like, yeah, I fucking hate Guatemalans. I hate El Salvador. Like, dude, chill, dude. It's like, what the fuck did they do to you, bro? He's like, yeah, fuck Venezuela. Oh, gotta love Mexico, bro. Gotta love Mexico. Yeah.
We'll dig into that in another time, man. It's interesting, the little cultural conflicts that exist. But yeah, that is the answer between Mexico and Argentina. There is no beef. It's just one-sided. It's a delusion that the Mexicans have in their head that there's some sort of beef.
Yeah, it makes sense, dude. They have to be relevant somehow, dude.
Yeah, Argentinians don't care or don't think about Mexico.
Yeah. All right, brother. Okay. Hopefully, this is helpful for coaches out there and, you know, can take at least one nugget of advice into the final and hopefully it helps them a little bit.
Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches, you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player.